Reverend Jackson's scripture from this morning from Ecclesiastes 3. You find it in your bulletin, probably on the screen as well, a familiar passage. There is a season for everything and a time for every matter under the heavens, a time for giving birth and a time for dying, a time for planting and a time for uprooting what was planted, a time for killing and a time for healing, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time for crying and a time for laughter, a time for mourning and a time for dancing, a time for throwing stones and a time for gathering stones, a time for embracing and a time for avoiding embraces, a time for searching and a time for losing, a time for keeping and a time for throwing away, a time for tearing and a time for repairing, a time for keeping silent and a time for speaking, a time for loving and a time for hating, a time for war and a time for peace. The word of the Lord.
How can you not get romantic about baseball? Billy Beane. I fell in love with baseball when I moved to Denver. It just wasn't my thing before I got here. When I got here, though, I fell completely head over heels. If you want to know how much I love baseball, it is exactly 75 days from now until the home opener for the Colorado Rockies. I can tell you four exact reasons why I fell in love with baseball. Specifically, the Colorado Rockies, but baseball overall. Coors Field is affordable to visit. The Colorado Rockies' color is purple. Their mascot is a dinosaur. And Blue Moon is brewed on site. I quickly became a romantic for baseball when I moved here, which influences my entertainment, including my movies, and therefore influences my sermon anecdotes. The movie Moneyball is about baseball, and it came out 6 years ago about the 2002 Oakland Athletics. I didn't follow baseball then, so I'm not going to assume you know what happened to the 2002 Oakland Athletics. But their previous season had ended with them losing to the New York Yankees in the playoffs, after having won the first two games of a five-game series. And that's where the movie starts, with a team with a very stripped-down budget who couldn't beat a team with an unlimited budget and therefore incredible talent that they had bought. Leadership was upset, the community of Oakland was upset, and the players that were gifted and had helped the Oakland Athletics get to that playoff season were now being poached for higher salaries from teams with larger budgets. Enter Billy Beane, the man I just quoted. He was the Oakland Athletics general manager and a previous Major League Baseball player who needed to rebuild the team and has been quoted saying, "I hate losing more than I even want to win." If sports aren't your thing and your eyes are quickly glazing over, I have a silver lining for you. The movie actually isn't about baseball. It's actually about statistics and mathematical analysis of baseball. Yeah. I'd like to tell you I'm kidding, but the truth is the movie was just much more creative about what the storyline was about, creating a story around the baseball. Billy Beane recognizes his reality in the story. He has a limited budget. He has no all-star players. He has a goal of winning the World Series. And he has a current process that continues to churn out the same results. If you keep doing what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And he doesn't like the results that they're getting. Beane is posed with a choice, and while it may seem obvious to us, I'm not sure we're always apt to take it. Does he meet with his scouts? Does he listen to the recommendations? Do they put together a team to replace the people that left as free agents and fill his roster using the same habits and the same expectations and the same patterns that baseball has always done? Or does he try new things? dramatically new things, uncomfortable things, things that actually contradict what they've done in the past? Does he do what perhaps is most controversial? Does he do new things that contradict the wisdom that got baseball to where it was in 2002? Many scholars and theologians have questioned the inclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes in our Bible. And they question it for very similar reasons. It focuses upon the limits and the contradictions in life and explores the absurdity of a simplistic theology. The wisdom of Ecclesiastes challenges the overall theology of the prophets. Much of our prophetic literature, be it Isaiah or Micah or Jonah or Jeremiah, follows a trend of accusations of wickedness and therefore judgment and punishment by God. The behavior of the Israelites justifies the destruction of Jerusalem. The Israelites sin and the temple is destroyed. The Israelites do not practice prayer and they serve other gods and they live sinful lives and therefore they are exiled. And if they would only be pious and righteous and just, the Israelites would experience the glory of God. They would experience atonement. They would experience a fruitful land of milk and honey. But it's within Ecclesiastes that we learn that goodness and righteousness does not always equal success, and wickedness does not always lead to failure. Circumstance, perspective, and life's complexities all turn events and scenarios and our habits of life on their head. Ecclesiastes, in all of its wisdom, has been questioned for its lack of coherence and its contradiction, and its radical questioning of the traditions that we've been taught. And this morning's scripture is about the same thing, even if you don't realize it at first. The opposing items list may seem like a list of right or wrong, good versus bad, but the reality of the matter is that our circumstances can invert our views and how we experience something. If you're unsure what I mean, let's take a literal look at the scripture that we're given. There's a season for everything. Without the death of autumn and winter, it is scientifically impossible to have the birth and the renewal of spring and summer. When we are in life, we experience perspectives and opportunities that shift in a way that we recognize that there is both health in seasons of crying as well as seasons of laughter. That there are opportunities for grief and mourning, as well as seasons of dancing. And Scripture teaches us that there's times for both tearing down as well as repairing. And they're often not the same season. We could walk through each of the pairings, but I'm guessing you're capable of reading the Scripture as well as I can and thinking back in your life and those opportunities. We know that each pair offers a healthy perspective on both sides of it at different points in our life. And life is a journey of contradictions. There are times in which doing something that looks like it's completely destroying our life is actually working towards exactly what we're trying to achieve. It's the science behind pruning, right? You want the plant to grow, and in order for the plant to grow and blossom, you actually start cutting it back. You remove the flowers, and you might actually end up with a plant that looks ugly. And while some may say, why are you destroying that bush, you know that it's actually getting you closer to your goal of a strong and larger and healthier plant by pruning it than if you had left it how it was. Literal destruction is what leads to the fullness and the richness of new life. When I moved to Denver, my love for baseball was not the only thing that changed. Everything in my life changed when I moved here. I had been living in Chicago for almost a decade, which might be why I didn't fall in love with baseball before I got to Denver. But it's in Chicago where I had family and I had friends, and I had friends that had become family. I had a career and a job that was fulfilling my financial needs as well as my altruistic needs. I lived in a part of the country that I had been raised in, and I was familiar with the culture of the Midwest. I was finding my own independent path through that. And what I did next, some might describe as I completely destroyed my life. I left my home. I left my family and my friends. I left my job and my career. I left my community and my culture. I moved across the country with one friend, and I started grad school without a job. I liquidated my health savings account and I liquidated my 401k so that I could pay for rent, so I could pay for food, and so that I could pay for tons and tons and tons of books, so that I could go to school for a career that I actually wasn't guaranteed. You see, the path to ordained ministry doesn't just include school and books, but then you have to be interviewed and you have to be vetted. And then you have to be voted on by a group of your peers. And suddenly, something is in the hands of many other people that get to give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And when I was asked to explain myself why I was resigning my job and moving across the country, oftentimes by people that aren't Methodist, and sometimes not even Christian, I had to look them in the eye and say, well, God's calling me to do that. And they'd say, like, God talked to you? And I'd say, no, oh, no. It's not as simple as being told this. It's just, you know, a gut feeling. Okay. Good luck with that. You see, sometimes change isn't gradual or just tweaks in your habits or behavior from year to year or experience to experience. And the movie Moneyball shows us just that. He decides to make some dramatic changes. Billy Bean hires a new assistant general manager to analyze the players, to base strictly on statistics, especially their ability to get on base. He doesn't have them look at their hitting percentage. He doesn't have them look at their runs batted in. He doesn't even have them look at their pitching or the defense on the field. Billy Bean and his assistant general manager just want to know who can get from home plate to first base, oftentimes by a walk, never mind even a hit. And they want to know if they can leverage a team that can get a bunch of people that can get to first base so they can slowly, one player at a time, work people around the bases and across home plate again to have a higher score at the end of each game. The scouts and the coach for the Oakland Athletics were dismissive at first, and then as they realized that their roles and the way they have done their job is being questioned and challenged and changed completely without their input, and their jobs are at stake, they become straight up hostile. And Bean is accused of trying to destroy the Oakland Athletics. What Bean was doing was upsetting everyone so much because he was radically questioning tradition. And the writer of Ecclesiastes radically questions tradition. And this is usually where faith communities and congregations and churches experience their greatest stumble. And it's where I felt the most resistance in answering my call and starting my ministry, a secular nonprofit, instead of leading a local church. People are emotionally invested in the way things have been done. And many of us in the church have been taught even some minor version of prosperity gospel. If you keep plugging along, good will beget good. And good equals success. We have a choice that invites us into something different, though, as we read this morning's scripture. We can commit to the path tradition has historically set upon and keep doing things the way they've always been done. Or we can look at the mission that tradition had before them. What was tradition working towards? And we can recognize that we can work towards that same goal that has been set before us in the years and the decades and the generations before us, and that we may just simply achieve that goal differently. And how we understand and engage failure as we work towards that mission and goal and that endeavor might be different as well. I don't know about you this past week, but my week has been full of reflection. I've done a lot of listening. I've read a lot of articles and a lot of commentary on the internet. And I've chosen very distinct paths of action and inaction over the last 8 days. I've considered and celebrated aspects of Martin Luther King's life this past week that we like to lift up, and I've also considered the different pieces of his life and the ways he lived out his leadership that history has conveniently swept under the rug, either because it makes us uncomfortable or it reminds us of his humanity. I've witnessed and participated in a myriad of reactions due to one presidency ending and one presidency beginning. And I marched yesterday with people that I consider friends, and I marched with people I consider colleagues, and I marched with people that I have never met before and may never cross paths with again. Thousands of strangers, and those strangers offered messages that I both agreed with and disagreed with. Messages of hate towards the current president and messages of loving one another unconditionally, and a variety of messages in between on that spectrum. And while weighing this past week's experiences along with today's scripture, and a belief that God is calling us into new life and changing within ourselves time and again throughout our lives, I realized, in a way that perhaps hindsight's 20/20, that maybe party affiliation today doesn't actually matter. Maybe whether you grieved on Thursday night or celebrated on Friday morning doesn't really matter, and how you voted 2 months ago doesn't really matter today as much as we want to say it does. Perhaps we, as a nation of citizens, are actually being called back into the relationship with our nation that the original forefathers imagined. People that argued and debated and were invested in calling and talking to their political representatives. Perhaps we have grown accustomed to checking boxes once a year or, God forbid, once every 4 years, and we're actually being called to do more than check a box. Perhaps we are feeling called to be active participants in our own reality, in our own personal faith, in our public voice, and the ways in which Jesus Christ is asking us to follow his leadership in both our personal faith and our public voice. As you contemplate today's theologically unconventional scripture, I challenge you to pause in prayer and to ask yourself, where is God calling you? Where is God calling you and your partner and your family? Where is God calling Burns Memorial United Methodist Church? Where is God calling the city of Aurora and the greater Denver area? Because I'm not going to tell you that I know the answer. And I'm not going to tell you that the call that God has on your life is the same as the person sitting to your left and your right. Are you called to ministry and to live your life as you always have, as the patterns and the habits have allowed you to over the last few years? Are you called to do ministry and live your life the way you've been raised to, as you've found comfortable and predictable? Or is God calling you and this community to create disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world? Is God calling you to be transformed within yourself? Is God calling you to a new season or to change in some way that you haven't anticipated? Is God calling you to engage your day-to-day life in a way that breaks your habits and norms so that you can continue towards the goal and the mission that you've always worked towards? You just might be doing it differently today than you did yesterday. Ecclesiastes and Moneyball teach us to go for the bold move, working towards our historically common goal, our mission, our vision for who we can be. Ecclesiastes in the movie teach us that failing is important, that numbers and tangible results do not determine success, but learning from our failure, adjusting, becoming something new tomorrow does. Ecclesiastes in the movie teach us that my moving from Chicago to answer call into ministry wasn't quitting or destruction of a previous life, but listening and recognizing a season and a circumstance of life. And all of it teaches us that we will most likely experience dismissiveness and even hostility as we journey through radical change, seeking not to dishonor the work that has been done before, but to honor the goal and the mission set by that very tradition. Billy Beane has a very specific way he wants to see his choices and the changes to the Oakland Athletics play out. He says, if we don't win the last game of the series, they'll dismiss us. He continues, I know these guys. I know the way they think, and they will erase us. And everything we've done here, none of it will matter. Any other team wins the World Series, good for them. They're drinking champagne. They get a ring. But if we win on our budget with this team, we'll have changed the game. And that's what I want. I want it to mean something. And while I'm not willing to say that the 2002 Oakland Athletics season was an act of God, I will say that God acts in mysterious ways. The Oakland Athletics 2002 season, they went on to win a record-setting 20 games in a row. And they did not survive the playoffs that year. The Anaheim Angels won the World Series. And although the Oakland Athletics have yet to win a World Series, even though they allowed that change to live in them and they've carried it forward. They've changed their approach to recruiting and baseball management, and in doing so, they have changed the game of baseball. One person changed one team, and that one team has now forever changed a sport that many would say this nation identifies with. Until you go home and watch the playoffs of the football today, but give yourself 75 days. The next season after the Oakland Athletics and Billy Beane changed the Oakland Athletics, the next season, multiple teams across Major League Baseball went out and they hired economists and statisticians as one of the many steps of how they changed looking at players and how they looked at teams and how they looked at their goals. And in 2004, the Boston Red Sox won their first pennant since 1918. Both teams had the same goal, and both teams had to be willing to recognize their circumstances and knew that if they wanted to forge a different path, they would have to acknowledge that was a different path than they'd ever taken before. And that their goal and the mission and their call on their life was worth doing something different, even if it was for the first time.
Thank you, Elizabeth. How many of you learned something about baseball? About something else as well. Thank you, Elizabeth.